Sounds like fun. So, and one of these days I am going to take my son across the country and try to hit every ballpark out there. And you know, we might not all do it in one summer, but I would like to try to, you know, correct. Long trip by your father or something. But love the baseball, the tradition, the rivalries, and the tradition of the great players, and the legacy they've handed down. It's a good sport.
Oh yeah.
I love the area. I'd move here in a heartbeat if my wife wanted to avoid the winter.
Well, you know, I just went out to
the
warming from
south. There you go.
So
maybe
the right temperature.
Maybe it's down about 5 or 10 years.
Try to sell that.
I just don't know about that. On our wit's end with the humid summers down in the Taiwan.
It is. I guess this summer, not this winter and summer.
I do all stuff. I'm not even sure we're going to do
it. Actually, I don't know what they're going to do, but I'm recording it.
I heard that. So.
Yeah, it'll be on the post on the internet.
Welcome to Theodore Parker's 300th anniversary celebration. And I'm Cynthia Bertram, and I'm one of the members of the 300th anniversary committee. And one of our members, Diane, I don't know where she's going, but let's get in the kitchen, had originally suggested that we might read a book as part of our activities this year. And we were hunting for a book, and she came across Tony Williams' book. And it was, you know, a couple of us also did our own sort of content. Find a lot of books that really fit with the time when our church started. And the wonderful thing is that not only was this book a book that had so many connections with our early history, but it also was a great story, and it was just about the right time because we started in 1712 and 1721. So Tony's going to be talking about his book today. Just a little bit of information. Tony is a historian, and he's a writer, and a teacher, and he's a father and a husband, and he has a lot of responsibilities, and he took this weekend out to come up here to New England to be able to be part of our celebration. He will have some books that he's written several books. He has samples of the others, but he has multiple copies of the Doctrine and Covenants, so if you haven't gotten your own copy, you can get one, you can buy one, and get it signed today. And it would be a great present to give to somebody. So there'll be that opportunity at the end. After Tony finishes speaking, we'll have a reception in the back. And Julie has the keys to the sanctuary. And if anyone would like to go over there and see the windows, if anyone is visiting or just wanted to go and see the windows, that'll be an opportunity as well. And while I'm up here, we should also just mention our upcoming November celebration, the date being
November
through November, when we're going to have a big kind of concluding ceremony. So, and the silver is on display, at least for the rest of this year.
At the Museum of Fine Arts.
At the Museum of Fine Arts. So, yes.
And we have commemorative mugs that we'll be selling in the reception.
Oh, So, anyhow, I'll turn the floor over to Tony now.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for coming out. I understand that I'm up against the Patriots. So, believe me, I understand how you feel about the Patriots and the Red Sox and all that. And so I am especially grateful that you're here. And hopefully you DVR the game or whatever you do to watch it later. So I do appreciate that. And thank you for the nice introduction, as I said earlier, at the service. It's a real honor to be here and to be invited up to the 300th anniversary. Congratulations on that. Very long and distinguished history. And so that's great. What was I going to say? So I have the book, and oh well, it's gone. But Well, let me tell you a little bit about the book. I guess we'll get started, and I assume everyone can hear me, and we don't need to mess with all this stuff and project, and I understand it's being recorded, so it will be forever on the internet, so watch what I say. Let's put ourselves back in 1721 and go back to a thriving port city of Boston, which had all of about 10,700 people or so. So it was the largest city in North America, and really, from rough estimates, I think about the second biggest city in the entire British Empire. So second only to London, really. So by their standards, it was a very large city and a thriving metropolis. Well, during this time, prior to April, in the late winter, there was a ship coming up from Barbados, and there was a sailor on it, interestingly enough, an African sailor, who had contracted smallpox down in Barbados. But you don't show symptoms, you're asymptomatic for about 10 to 14 days, and so you must have caught it at some point during the voyage up here, landed in Boston, and they didn't need to quarantine the ship because no one was apparently sick. And so they rolled into Boston Harbor, and the sailor went ashore on leave with most of the other sailors on this British warship, which is part of the continental ships. And this sailor was walking around and probably ran into a bunch of sailors he knew from the town and had probably visited Boston before and knew people and maybe went to his favorite taverns for a drink or two, maybe went to some shops and bought things and that kind of thing, shaking hands, saying hello to everyone. And the whole time he was there, he was, of course, spreading smallpox at every single person he was interacting with. And the ship rolled into town, we know, in April, late April of 1721. Well, they found out in early May that he had smallpox, and he did give it to, again, interestingly enough, another African sailor, this one from Boston, and they both, the town knew they both had smallpox, so they immediately quarantined the home, sent a couple of nurses into their homes, and posted guards outside the door and hung a red flag outside the door, which said, "God have mercy on their souls." And truly, they needed it. The town also went to quarantine the ship. They sent a doctor on board the ship. It was filled with smallpox from the remaining sailors on board. They immediately quarantined the ship in Boston Harbor. And they said, "Phew, we have it contained," and all that. Well, of course, it was a fool's hope. Okay, a few weeks later, right, in the Boston Gazette, it was reported that there were 8 more cases of smallpox around the town. And I have the John Bonner map from 1721, and had a copy of that, I said, or 1722, I guess. And it all the street names, I was able to plot it out, and I took these 8 cases, and I said, wow, there was all over Boston, in every corner of Boston, there was at least one smallpox case. And of course, each of those people were interacting with family members and going to taverns and going to Puritan meeting houses and Anglican churches and going to work and walking around town and so forth. And at that point, obviously, a great fright took over the city. Well, this is in June, and of course, word is getting out about the smallpox, and everyone's afraid, and you can imagine that people aren't leaving their homes and they're going to churches to pray for relief because, of course, there was no antidote or cure for the smallpox. And it was a terrifying disease, and it was one that came about every 19 or 20 years. Once enough people had been born who did not have immunity to it, the population would sustain a new round of an epidemic when the ship would roll. So they were terribly frightful and would go off to their Puritan meeting houses and spread smallpox those who were infected. At the same time, they were seeking relief from above. And who should respond to this crisis? So I'm going to give it away for those of you who are in the service, but a perhaps the foremost scientists of his day reacted. He was a member of the Bridge for All Society, went to Harvard at 11, was starting the first scientific society in Boston, in America, actually, and wrote an autobiography in which he tried to teach his kids lessons. And by this point, for those of you who weren't there right this morning, of course, everyone would have seen that this is Benjamin Franklin. But it was actually Reverend Cottonmouth. Okay, probably the foremost scientist of his day here in American colonies. Remember the Bridge for All Society, the most prestigious scientific body in the world, was a very scientifically minded minister. He would preach about heliocentrism and a sun-centered universe right from the pulpit. So, and followed the latest scientific news coming out of Europe and so forth, and was part of this international conversation of reason during the Enlightenment. And so he had learned about smallpox, about inoculations, about 5 or 6 years before this. And he was a curious, scientifically minded guy, so he was just, he noticed the scar on the arm of one of the slaves. And he asked him about it, and he said, you know, what's the scar in it? And he said, have you been inoculated? That looks like an inoculation scar. And the slave said, yes and no. And you can imagine this one scientific man in the American colony sitting there with a quizzical look on his face, well, what do you mean, yes and no? So the slave patiently explained to Pot Matter, this very highly educated individual, that he said, yes, I had smallpox, but no, not normally in the way that you would probably think. And so he explained the inoculation to him. And the inoculation, you've probably a lot of people mentioned as early in the service, about the John Adams series, right? You've seen that, and this kind of horrific look into the 18th century that they would, you know, they'd make an incision, they'd take live smallpox virus from a victim, and mix it in, and you would get smallpox, right? And most people would generally survive. Now, you would get smallpox, and you would go through the symptoms, but generally most people would survive. What they figured out is that the death rate is down about 1-3%. If you got through the respiratory system, and I think there was a doctor in the house, sorry, there you go, an epidemiologist, no doubt, right, of course. But if you got through the respiratory system, the death rate was up around 15-30%. You know, they couldn't explain it, and at least in some of the Muslim literature I've read, still can't, but maybe you can shed some light on that as we discuss later. So the death rate was much, much lower. Most people survived. And so, but Mather got the information from his slave. Mm-hmm. He was open-minded enough to say, this slave, this African from the non-Western, non-enlightened parts of the world, has information we don't, has knowledge that we don't have. Interestingly enough, right around that same time, within only a few months' period of talking to the slave, he read about inoculation being practiced over in Greece and Turkey, which was, of course, part of the Ottoman Empire, dominated by Muslims at that time. And that knowledge came to the Bridge for All Society and then was disseminated in their journal, the Transactions. And Mather, as a member of the Royal Society, wrote about the inoculation being practiced in all non-Western, non-Christian, unenlightened, quote-unquote, parts of the world. And Mather said, hey, from a couple of different sources, right? I'm not a scientist, right? I teach history, but I know enough about the scientific method from my kids studying fourth grade science to know that that's what he did. He was open-minded and scientific, and he learned about information from a few sources, and he started to form a hypothesis, and wanted to test it, right? Like a good scientist. And so he resolved, if there's another epidemic in Boston, and this is one of Mather's really main faults is that he waited until then. He waited until the middle of an epidemic. And it's one thing we can fault him for. He probably should have tried to inoculate people at that point. Because, you know, people get smallpox every now and again, even with that epidemic. So he resolved, if there is an epidemic in Boston, I am going to resolve to call a consort of physicians or a meeting of the doctors to get together and try to practice it.
Well, this is back in about 1716. And so when 1721 rolls around and there is a massive epidemic gripping Boston in great fright, he does that. He writes a letter to the doctors of the town, saying, hey, you guys should really try inoculation. I've heard about it from some different sources. Let's help people. He was very civic-minded, a lot like Benjamin Franklin would be in Philadelphia. And of course, he didn't get one response. And he was met with stony silence, as I say in the book. And Mather was probably rather shocked at this, because he was, how should we say, somewhat vain. And as a man of the Enlightenment, he just thought, why don't people listen to reason? Why don't they listen to me? Right? I'm glad I don't suffer from that. Right? Well, if you just listen to reason, I tell my wife that all the time. So, and I met with the same stone silence that I mean. The husbands are laughing way too loud on this side. But he was met with that silence, and now meanwhile, you know, the smallpox is spreading, they've taken the guards off the door, they know that they can't do anything about it, they know that it's just going to run its course. One person, I think, died in June, 8 will die in July, and the death toll is going to go up. And so that the epidemic is spreading, hundreds and hundreds of people are getting sick. Well, Mather, undeterred by being ignored, and as a man of enlightenment, still wants to convince these people that he has a really great idea, and writes more letters. And since it's a small town, I don't really have evidence for it, but you can imagine him meeting the doctors in the streets and going to their homes and talking to them and really trying to persuade them of this cure of sorts, or this inoculation. And so he does find one doctor, Dr. Boylston, right? I think the street in Boston, right? Boylston Street. And he convinces him, this one doctor, every other doctor said, no, and we'll talk about the reasons why. He finds one doctor to give it a try. Now, Boylston had smallpox, so he knew. They knew enough about smallpox to know that you would never get it again in your life. You were immune for life. You get it once, you build immunity, you never get it again. So he couldn't test it on himself, which is what he wanted to do. He was a scientist. He was actually willing to do that. So, but he couldn't do it on himself, and so he had to find some subjects. He actually did it on his own 6-year-old son and his two slaves. Now, when the book came out, my son was 6 years old, and he's about 9 now. And I always said, when I would give the talk to the book first, I said, I have a 6-year-old son. And even though he's 9 now, I still wouldn't change the perspective of saying, I don't know how many of us would be willing to test an untried medical procedure that could kill him on our own children. And yet he did. Interestingly enough, he also tried it on his two slaves. One was a father and one was a son. So there was another young boy and then also a father. Now, I could never find out in personal research whether they gave their consent or not. And it's just a fascinating thing to speculate about, isn't it? That now I'd like to think, right, that having gotten to know Dr. Boylston in the course of my research, that he did actually ask for their permission. But we can easily imagine with our understanding of slavery that he didn't, that he just went ahead and forced them to test it on them, and they had to live with it. Although his son took a turn for the worse, and you can imagine the fear that I remember, that they did all survive. Whew. You know, the son survived, all the slaves survived, and he had some actual experimental proof that inoculation seemed to work. Okay, and you know, I think he probably went back and retested them and tried to get them smallpox virus to take. And it was not an open secret that he was doing it. Well, people heard about the inoculation, and lots of people actually came to be inoculated. And so I guess in late June, early July, he's got about 700 patients already. And the town goes ballistic. And the town is outraged, right? They said, how can you give people smallpox when they're already getting it. Right? This just did not make sense to them, right? And it's very interesting if you look at the two sides, which I do in the book, about who lined up for it and who lined up against it. Okay? The ministers, right, including Mary, said, you know, we need to test this scientifically. God gave us reason to discover these medical truths, and so let's go ahead and test our theory and see if it works, because in the end this will help people, and that's after all what doctors do. They're supposed to preserve life and help people. And you know, so he thought very scientifically throughout, also took more of a natural law approach than sort of the Puritanism and the predestination and it's God's will and so forth. That was actually the argument of the doctors of Boston, that this is God's will that people are getting sick, and you can't interfere with that because the whole reason we're getting it in the first place is God is punishing us and allowing, you know, like in the book of Job, allowing the devil to run amok among us and spread this epidemic. And so you'll just incur God's wrath if you do this. That's the doctors, right? They're Puritans, but it's the doctors rather than the ministers who are saying this. It's fascinating. And of course, Mather and the other ministers responded, well, if it's God's will that people get sick and we can interfere, then why should we have doctors at all? Makes sense. So, touche, right? You know, it's an excellent rejoinder there. The other thing is, and I find this probably the more despicable of all the arguments, the doctor said, you got your information from your slave, which is something Mather, to his credit, in something, you know, I think would be very liberal-minded even for 2012, said he never hid that fact. He always openly admitted that he got his information from his slave. Even though he started to be attacked for it. He didn't try to, like, you know, flip-flop or switch positions or anything like that. He said, look, he never did that thing. And it was the doctor who said, you can't learn from those Africans. They're sneaky, they're liars, they're ignorant. Why would we trust something that's been done among Africans, right? They just were seen as less than human by the doctors. Mather, as I said, to his credit, never hid that fact and said, we can learn from them just as well as anyone. Also, in addition to that, the doctor also said, well, you got your information in part, we know, from those Muslims over in Greece and Turkey, over in the Middle East, and you can't learn from them either. They're pagans, right? They're not Christians. And Mather responded, oh, we can't learn from pagans? You mean like the Greco-Roman doctors that you base your whole practice on? You mean like Hippocrates in ancient Greece or Galen in ancient Rome? Do you mean those pagans? Because if we can't learn from pagans, maybe you guys should give up your practice of medicine, because they were still practicing medicine the way with the balance of the four humors and all that. They were still practicing medicine as if it were in Greece and Rome, as if there was no scientific revolution taking place. So, you know, it was an excellent rejoinder, and he said, no, we can learn from anyone around the world. In fact, Mather believed and stated that God gave them special knowledge, like a special providence, special knowledge, that we didn't get. And so he's saying, you know, they're somehow more or less unfortunate than we are, even in the enlightened, very scientific, very advanced West, in the stage of reason. They have knowledge that we don't. And you know, this interaction is good so that we can learn from them as well as we can teach them things too. So it was, I don't know, you want to call it, you know, liberal-minded, multicultural. I mean, he was very open-minded and tolerant about all this stuff. Which is, again, very different from the crucible, right? From our, you know, typical understanding of history, you know, presents the Puritans perhaps in somewhat of a new light, and especially Mather himself, the famous witch hunter. So you have all these arguments swirling around, and the doctors were also saying things like, why are you giving people smallpox or are you getting it? They just couldn't, even the doctors couldn't understand this whole inoculation thing. You know, maybe against vaccinations, I don't know. And so it was the ministry just said, no, let's try it out. In fact, they said, look, we'll take a patient and we'll bring them out into Boston Harbor on the island here. We'll totally isolate them from anyone. If things go horrifically wrong, some doctors are claiming like they sprout three heads and like their chest cavity would explode and like monsters would come out and all this crazy stuff. And he said, look, let's inoculate one person. You can come and witness them. You can see the evidence for yourselves, and we'll see if this is an efficacious practice, medical practice. And to their discredit, the doctor said no. They refused to do so. And Dr. Douglas is sort of the antagonist, Mather's antagonist from this whole story. He wouldn't even let Mather had either borrowed or lost his copy of the transaction describing the inoculation because Mather said, look, we want to make sure we're doing this correctly. We don't want to put anyone in unnecessary danger. We want to make sure we're doing this right. And the Dr. Douglas said, no, he refused to let him in the journal. And he just, you know, tried to block him every step of the way. And would refuse to see even one totally isolated patient that could never be harmed in anyone. And Douglas was a mean too, so it's not like he gets off to be one of the visitors. So the way the slides line up is just fascinating, right? It's curious, it's not what we would expect, and seems to revise some of our opinions about this stuff. Well, in the middle of all this, you know, more and more people are getting sick, more and more people are dying. In July, you know, that handful of people, 8 or 10 people are dying. By the time August rolls around, I mean, the number jumps up to like 26, and there are 100 sick. Mather is praying for hundreds and hundreds of people in his congregation. He has all these massive prayer lists, and he's trying to. Meanwhile, people are assaulting him in the streets and questioning what he's doing. In August, in early August, who should stumble in to this furor? And all this debate. Don't forget, it's a very literate Boston. It's a very, very literate society with the intention of reading the Bible and converting and all that. And so the idea is that this debate plays itself out very, very publicly. The pages of the newspapers, and Boston had the most newspapers in the colonies. It had two, and then the third was added, as we'll get to in a sec. Pamphlets are being written for and against inoculations. In this very literate society, this whole debate takes place. Well, who should stumble into this whole debate but a young Ben Franklin and his brother? Right? Franklin is all about 15 or 16 years old. He was born in 1706. And his older brother is the publisher of this newspaper after spending time in England. And they actually start an anti-inoculation newspaper, right? You can't make this stuff up, right? It's just incredible. Now, to be fair to Mather, before you have a question, Mather never personally wrote against smallpox. Okay, to his credit, we have to admit that right up front. But he served as a mouthpiece, and his newspaper served as a mouthpiece for every scurrilous, scandalous, nasty attack upon the ministry, and Dr. Wilson. They would just print anything. They printed this one satire, which said, "Oh, smallpox is inoculation is okay. All right, well, why don't we do this? Why don't we take smallpox? We'll put it on a bunch of blankets and clothing and so forth. We'll bring it over to the Indians." And we'll inoculate them, and then see if they survive or not. Okay, so we'll inoculate them, and then spread smallpox among them, and see if it works. If it doesn't, they'll all die. But if they survive, then we'll see that your new practice works. Okay, I mean that's just a nasty satire, right? And yet it's being printed gleefully in the pages of the New England Courant. They're called doggerel poems, other satirical articles against them, and just attacks on inoculations, and all these warnings by these supposed experts that all these horrible things are going to happen to the patients who are inoculated and so forth. And so this Franklin Brothers newspaper And now really, really sets things off and really gets the public to be very, very vicious for and against. So this is an August. Meanwhile, 26 people are dying. By September, 111 people died of smallpox. The town shut down. You know, as summer turning into autumn, they're not letting people, really too many people in or out of town. People are scared to collect firewood or go get it, and then they're back. They're afraid it's going to spread all over town. The commencement services from Harvard are shut down in the summer. And, you know, businesses are closed. Life is completely, you know, social interaction is completely shut down. So, you know, you think about it, you know, people just, you know, their social interactions and relationships, all of that, really, civil society, and really just very kind of lost. Well, in the middle of this, I wanted to tell the story of a group of people in Boston. They didn't really leave a lot of written sources behind, but they were very, very important to this whole epidemic, and also to the inoculation. There were a group of people that when children got sick, when a loved one got sick, they would tend them by the fire. You can't really swallow smallpox when it goes in your throat, and it's very hard to eat anything or to swallow anything, extremely painful. So they might drop, you know, squeeze a cloth and drop just a few drops of water down the throat. They would tend the fire. They would maybe go into the recipe books that have been handed down by their mothers and their grandmothers. They usually had some combination of herbal remedies and also food recipes and that kind of thing, and tending gardens. And they might look in there for a cure. You know, they would stay up through the night with loved ones, even at the expense of their own well-being. Of course, you know who I'm talking about, the great unsung heroes of this epidemic, the women of Boston. Right. I wanted to try to retrieve their story and tell their story because, you know, they weren't necessarily in the middle of this public debate, but they were quietly taking care of their own. And it's interesting, they knew just as much as most of the doctors because of these herbal remedies and because of their understanding of the humors and so forth. It really wasn't any different than even those who studied, like Dr. Douglas over in Europe and had his fancy education from the University of Leiden and studied in London and all these fancy universities, but you know they knew about as much as they did in terms of some of the classical practices of medicine. And of course, tended you know people very quietly. And you can imagine you know going next door to their neighbors and tending to their relatives and other sick ones, people around the neighborhood. You know, I recreated this story even though we didn't have a lot of sources for them. I thought that was an important story to tell. Well, in the middle of this, people are still dying, 111 in September. By October, there's 400 plus dying from smallpox. I mean, it's just incredible. And don't forget, it's a city of almost 11,000 people. And 1,000 people had fled as soon as the epidemic hit. They fled for their lives. And hopefully not too many of them are sick. No. Of course, as they fled for their lives, some of them might have been sick, and now they're spreading it all around, you know, Massachusetts. In New England, and so that was a very dangerous thing to do as well. But, you know, over 400 people died. And what's interesting is Kant Manor, it was, you know, I don't want to say he was blind about it, but it was easy for him to recommend inoculation because he thought it was a good, successful way to prevent smallpox for other people. But then when it came to his own children, especially his son came to him and said, you know, Father, should I get inoculated? And he was paralyzed. He didn't know what to do. And so Mather, as father, as family man, has to face its own thing. And again, it's great for everybody else, but whoa, this is an old man at home. And he knows that his son could possibly die of inoculation. He literally did not know what to do. I mean, he prayed, he thought about it, and he actually had to go to his father in Greece. I love his name. It's very cotton in Greece, whatever. But actually, as an aside, my kids, in the middle of all this, I guess they're about 6 and 8 or so, and we have a big stuffed penguin. It's about almost as tall as I am. And one day they said, my daughter said to my son, all right, we're going to have a reading hour in my room or whatever. Go get Cotton Mather. Apparently, that was the big stuffed penguin. I don't know why they chose the penguin. And he still, to this day, can talk about it. Joins them occasionally for reading hour, which we still have. So, occasionally he's the target for my son's BB gun. Or not BB gun, the Nerf gun. Running in there like an ABC all that shooting at him. So, I don't know. Or comment. So anyway, all these people are dying, and he needs to think about whether his son should get inoculated, and goes to his father. The bloody grandfather says, what should I do? And they sit and talk about it, and you can imagine sort of the anguish in the midst of this conversation, and the very real human responses, right? We're fathers, we're mothers in this room, and think about a loved one, a sibling going through this, and so finally, he says, go ahead, let them have it, and now they're relaxed and lets them go through this. And his son also, just like Dr. Wilson's son, takes a turn for the worse. And you can just imagine just the fear and agony of the father and all of that. But he also does eventually pull through. I mean, you have symptoms going on. This is a long process to inoculate. It takes several weeks, okay, for even the symptoms to kick in, and then the fever starts, and the pustules come, and all that. I won't go into too much detail. But he does eventually pull through. He does pull through. So now he's relieved of that. In the middle of this debate, if you'll indulge me, I'm going to read a little bit from the book, because people are very, very angry about inoculation. As I said, they were assaulting men in the street, attacking me and the other ministers who pretty much all rallied around him in the pages of other newspapers and pamphlets and so forth. This is the response of one person to that. One person in Boston had had enough of a high and mighty cockmaster. He lorded his position over everyone, thinking he was better than everyone else. He was filled with rage that the fool minister was in league with the quack Boylston, actually giving people smallpox. What they were doing just did not make sense. The resentment boiled over for weeks, if not months, and was now about to explode. The person must have nervously sat in his home, an assortment of odd material spread out on the table. With quivering hands, the individual poured black powder into a spherical shape. Some liquid followed the powder into the metal ball. He probably feared that someone would knock on the door and discover what was going on. The figure went over to a desk and grabbed a quill, some ink, and a few small pieces of parchment. He might have thrown a couple of the scraps away, perhaps to satisfy that his feelings were properly conveyed. The individual chose his words carefully. The figure reached for a small cord of material and began to fasten it to the sphere. Now, I say he only because my editor, originally I wrote it to be completely gender neutral, that you wouldn't know, because we don't know if this figure was a man or a woman. My editor wrote for the more conventional he, but keep in mind that I don't know if this was a man or a woman. And so the matter home on Ship Street was still in the morning hours before dawn. Three guests slept fitfully in the lodging room. Mather's nephew, Reverend Thomas Walter, had traveled from Roxbury with two gentlemen in the Boston. Now, I just wrote that because it was a piece of evidence that I found. Apparently you guys know exactly who that is. from one of the churches. Pretty interesting. And Walter had risked the epidemic in order to, as Mather wrote, to undergo the smallpox inoculation and so return to the service of his flock, which had the contagion begun amongst them. So his rage and anger over fear in Rockford or West Rockford. Walter was one of the cases that had prompted the authorities to stop people from coming to town for that purpose. The authorities had shut it down and said, you cannot allow anyone to come back into town to get inoculated. They're going to bring it back to their towns around Boston and spread it all over Massachusetts, and we're all going to die, right? By the way, that reminds me of a point that they had also ordered Boylston to stop practicing inoculation about 8 or 10 times. But like a good New Englander, he said, I'm going to do it anyway, right? He's a good individualist and said, hey, this is helping people, and it's the right thing to do, so I'm going to persevere. They try to shut them down, but they keep inoculating those who came to him. And so there's a lot of good, grim determination on his part. So, let's see. Boylston had inoculated the three men on October 31st, but on this November evening, middle of the night, actually, he said, at roughly 3 o'clock in the morning on November 14th, a figure probably stood in the shadows, staring at the windows of the home and planning his escape route. The metal of the bomb was cold to the touch, but a source of fire was brought into contact with the fuse. He hurled the weapon toward the house. Shattered glass and an iron ball smashed onto the floor of Walter's bedroom and instantly awoke him and the others in the room. Mather came running into the room with his wife, his daughter Nancy, and his servants. The minister saw the sundered bomb lying in two pieces on the floor. He bent down to inspect it, seeing that, as he wrote in his great piece in Century Language, the granada was charged, right, the granada grenade, was charged the upper part with dry powder, the lower part with a mixture of oil, of turpentine and powder, and what else I know not. And I said, looking around the room, Mather deduced that the unexploded grenade, passing through the window, had, by the iron, as he wrote, in the middle of the casing, given such a turn to it that in falling upon the floor, the fire wildfire and the fuse was violently shaken out upon the floor without firing the granada. Okay. Everyone present, especially Walter and his traveling companions, knew that they were lucky to be alive. After all, as Mather wrote in his diary, the weight of the iron ball alone, had it fallen on Walter's head, would have been enough to have done part of the business designed. But if it had detonated, it surely would have killed them. Mather thought that, as he wrote, upon its going off, it must have split and have probably killed the persons in the room, and certainly fired the chamber and speedily laid my house in ashes. Interestingly, Mather picked up the broken pieces of the grenade to inspect it, and found a piece of paper tied to the fuse with a string that it might outlive the breaking of the shell. Now, I'm not quite sure why you would put a note on a bomb. So it might be a little hard to read. I guess I understand, down in my neck of the woods, you know, a lot of military, and sometimes they, write little messages on their bombs or whatever, drop. But as I say here, it's a dubious proposition that the parchment would survive the incendiary explosion, but the assailant wrote out the message and attached it anyway. I guess he just wanted to get his feelings out, and it read, "Cotton out of you, dog, damn you." Good to be around for us, right? I'll inoculate you with this with a pox on you. It's great stuff, right? Like a book that wrote itself, really. Now, Mather survived the assassination attempt. But as I was talking with some earlier, and this really gets to the idea of the covenant, now we all know that, Massachusetts in many ways was founded upon that idea of the city upon hill, that covenant, with God and each other to form a perfect society and form a perfect church. And this covenant really, redounded throughout every single part of society, right? There were church covenants, as you guys know. There was a covenant between a husband and a wife. There was basically a covenant between parents and children, although unwritten, right? There was a political covenant that the rulers would have to be godly and rule justly and so forth, and that the people had part of their covenant to obey their rulers, to obey their just rulers and so forth. And so there's covenants scattered throughout society and their churches and so forth. Some official, some less official. But nevertheless, they were rooted in a covenant. And part of that covenant was obviously respect for ministers. But as I argue in the book, now the Salem Witch Trials had something to do with it, and other social trends as well, of course. But I argue in the book that this had a lot to do with the declining authority of the ministers. I mean, it simply could not in many ways survive this level of attack, both physical, with this attempted assassination. I mean, you don't go around trying to kill the Puritan ministers, right? Not exactly a sign of respect. But likewise, all of that doggerel, all of that the satire, all the attacks and the feeds of these pamphlets, these newspapers, you know, their authority could not survive that either, and led to a long-term decline of their authority as well as the covenant upon which their whole society was founded. And as I argued, perhaps, you know, this covenant became much, you know, more of a secularized one in the course of the American Revolution, the one of rights and liberties and so forth. Still, they believe in God, so it still has its vestiges of religion, but, you know, more secularized version, less of a Puritan view. And, of course, we have the Great Awakening, which leads to this multiplicity of denominations and a more reasonable religion and a greater religious tolerance. Well, to give you some idea, we have the city of 10,000 plus, 1,000 people left. In the end, about 6,000 people were reported getting smallpox. I mean, my estimate is that every single person who was susceptible to smallpox got it. It's a highly contagious disease, spread to almost everyone, and those 4,000 or so people who didn't get it had surely pretty much had it in previous epidemics, and were probably, you know, probably in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and had kind of smallpox or one of the epidemics during the course of their life. Well, 6,000 got smallpox. As we would expect, about 1,000 of those died. So 16-17% in that range. It's actually a little bit low, you know, kind of on the low end of things, but right in our zone. And it would eventually extinguish in during the winter. And because there were no more human hosts to carry the disease, like, in addition to that, they inoculated Boston with matters of support there, inoculated about 250 people. Only 6 of those died. And so, you know, that's down in the range of what we expect from inoculation. And those 6, and that's a conservative number. And it's interesting, this is one of the first case studies that we ever had of an epidemic. I mean, you know, he wrote down every single case. You can read them, read the pamphlets that he published with the Royal Society about a decade later. Boston kept very careful case records and explained the symptoms and if they turned for the worse and then eventually whether they died or survived. Very careful records. Only 6 died, and that's a conservative number because we can imagine that if they got smallpox 10 minutes or 10 days before they were inoculated, you know, they might have gotten it on the way over. And you would, you know, there was no way for them to know whether it was the actual inoculation or whether they got it, you know, on their way. So they might have gotten more virulent form and not died of inoculation, but just died of smallpox. But that was a conservative risk. Only 6 died out of 250, so down around 2-3%. So they showed that it worked, and yet still there was opposition. In one of the more despicable parts of this whole episode, the following men, Boston starting up an inoculation camp, they were like, hey, we've shown that it works, right? And Dr. Douglas wrote a letter to a friend, okay, and I have the date on it and all that, telling his friend over in New York that, yeah, you know, the smallpox inoculation has been attempted. It's, I guess he kind of grudgingly admits, yeah, it's worked and all that. And you know, I was against it, but they've shown that it worked. That's why he's writing private with someone. And it was about two days later, he goes before the town selectman of Boston and says, this is a dangerous practice. It's going to lead to deaths. You cannot allow this. You have to shut it down. And he did. But it was very simple that privately he's admitting that it works, and then again he gets the town to shut it down because he's warning all these brave dangers of occurring. So that's one of the more despicable things of this whole thing. Franklin, where does he end up in all this? Well, obviously against this whole thing now, or maybe he just wanted to sell newspapers. He moves to Boston, of course, Philadelphia as a young man and becomes one of our great scientists and later loses a child to smallpox in 1736. His pregnant autobiography, I think he was a child of 4 years old. And he says, right in the pages of his autobiography, let this be a lesson to all the parents out there to get their children inoculated. Right? I'm like, today, right? But I said, let this be a lesson. Get your children or not. There's some danger about any of this and things. So he knew firsthand what it was like to do the problem himself. But they showed that it worked. It would spread to other coastal cities, spread to Charleston, South Carolina, to Norfolk, Virginia, where still inoculators were run out of town as late as 1764 because of the fears that this engendered. But they showed that it worked, and this would eventually lead to Edward Jenner's successful development of vaccination over in England in 1799, I believe is the date, and eventually its eradication from the world in about 1870-1980. They get down to the last few cases and then eradicated, so it's absent from human population today. It's one of the great medical discoveries, one of the great conquests of the disease. Not too long ago, by the way, we can trace it to Edward Jenner, to a very unlikely minister back in New York, Massachusetts. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I think I say in the preface to my book, I think, you know, thankfully my children haven't grown up in the world of all these diseases, and we've heard we have other diseases today. But, you know, thankfully we don't need to worry about things like that. Although, funny story, I just reminded us, my daughter got scarlet fever, right? She was sick, and I was like, scarlet fever, my wife and I are freaking out, looking at each other, like, oh, she's gonna die! And we're right there in the pediatrician's office, and he's like, oh, don't worry, it's just a rash. I was like, oh, okay. I learned what scarlet fever was. It's, you know, just simply a very high fever and a rash. I guess that's where you get the scarlet from. They gave her some antibiotics and we brought the fever down and she lived. She lived through scarlet fever, which, you know, killed an awful lot of people in Boston, I think 1703, and they had their routine epidemics. But you're right. In fact, while I was working on the book, I was giving a talk on my hurricane book. And I was like, well, thankfully it's gone. And one gentleman who was sitting at the table, he said, I had smallpox when I was in my mother's womb, or just right after he was born. And he said, I survived. And he said, I can't commit a crime. They'll pick me up in 10 minutes. Because he has all these little star-shaped scars on his fingers. So it helps prevent crime, too. yeah, I'll take part.
You know, I read the book last year, and I haven't bought my copy now, so I'm not as informed about it as some of the argument you make as I should be. I wish I were. But I'm interested in the group of doctors and then the sort of contesting the authority of being ministers.
Right.
It makes me think that disintegration of the Puritan minister's authority must have been happening before. For them to come out so strongly, all except Boylston. Was it part of the witch talk? Can you talk a little bit about how that developed?
Yeah, I mean, these are complicated trends and all that. I think it's just general. Generally also, I think we need to note long-term historical trends that, you know, the first pilgrims and Puritans, various dissenters of the Puritan strike, whether separatists or non-separatists, they took their covenant very, very seriously, right? This whole idea of a city upon a hill. In large part because if they didn't stick to it, you know, if they didn't stick to the Mayflower Compact and to this idea of the city of health, they could die, right? Part of that was a lot of brotherhood and cooperation, and we got to knit together as brothers, and you look at the language from Winthrop's sermon, and it's just startling. In a small excerpt I read with my students, there's about 20 references to, we need to cooperate. With the implicit message, we're going to a wilderness with, Native Americans. We don't know if they're hostile or not, and wild animals, and we can all die of starvation, and we really need to work together. Well, there's less of an imperative by the second generation. We've had the Great Migration and thousands of settlers, and they're established now, right? Massachusetts Bay, and they're starting to spread out in various towns. And there's just less of an imperative, and you know, the old covenant breaks down. I mean, you can see this in the halfway covenant, right? The idea that hey, no one's going to church anymore. You know, we really need to, you know, get people back in the church. One way is to just make it really easy for them to become church members, much easier than in 1620 and 1630. Well, you know, if they're baptized, they can become halfway members and so forth. And so that's in the 1660s. And then, yeah, I think sandwich trials have a lot to do with it. You know, what have we done? And, you know, the ministers were certainly, you know, at least partially responsible for everything. Although, you know, during the witch trials, they did also say, you know, hey, you know, what are we doing? And M. Carey Smith has this famous quote where he says, I'd rather suffer 10 witches than allow one innocent person to die. So it's not a complete story, but, you know, I think I think generally, you know, the covenant's breaking down. They're in their third generation by now, going on to fourth generation. People are moving away, they're forming their own churches, they feel less of a tie to the center of the community where they started. And they're interested in commercialism and fishing. It's just, you had the Great Awakening and the multiplying denominations and so forth. And so, for a lot of reasons, I think. And I don't think the smallpox epidemic by any means and the debate over inoculation is the only cause in this. But I think it's a significant addition.
Sort of thinking more about, and also imagine that the doctors might have thought of them, especially the fellow who said it, enlightened, mm-hmm. as a man of the enlightenment and reason, mm-hmm. as opposed to the minister, who were so, in his view, narrow-minded. And suddenly, who is this Puritan minister to be telling me,
right.
that my studies are for naught?
There is a lot of that. Yeah, I think that's a lot to do. It's, you know, ministers said. But on the other hand, you know, there was this long idea in Massachusetts of these pastor physicians, because they would, you know, people would go to them, especially early on, for medical help and all that, because they were the most educated. You know, they were the lead in society. And it's interesting, you know, but Mather just as much of a member of the British Royal Society as Dr. Douglas was. I mean, these are two very haughty individuals, very vain individuals. And you're right, there is also the sense that the doctors don't want the medic. And yet, also refuse to even say, okay, they could have even taken over an inoculation, right? Mather would gladly have said, look, but I do, but he wants all the doctors to be involved. He just doesn't want one doctor. He wants them all to do it. And so he would have said, sure, take that patient, go to Boston Harbor, inoculate it, see for yourself that it works, and I would like you to inoculate everyone in town so that you can save lives. And yet, to that degree, they didn't do it. And so they're resentful of his meddling, and yet also so closed-minded that they're unwilling to even listen to anything he has to say or to even do a talk. So let me get to some different people before we go around the room.
Thinking about that, the way I thought about the conflict between the ministers and the medical physicians is that mostly the ministers would be university educated, mm-hmm. and the doctors may not have been university educated, but were apprentice.
Right, exactly, right, yep.
And so there's a cultural divide as well as the jealousy, perhaps.
It's interesting. I mean, if we dig around in this, we see Mather went to Harvard, he studied some medicine there, studied science, and of course the other ministers in here are all very well educated. Douglas has an education to rival or surpass theirs. And yet all the other physicians that he's kind of controlling or manipulating or persuading, at least, to oppose the inoculation, you're right, they are mostly apprentices, they're local doctors, they didn't even go to Harvard, let alone the University of Leiden, which was the medical institution of the world, the best college in the world. So, yeah, I mean, you can throw a social class in here and education, and yet, what happened when you dig around in there, it only gets messier and messier. And I don't have any easy or facile answers, and I don't even know why they're facile answers. I mean, it's not just a matter of class. It's not just a matter of education, because you have these two giants, you know, going at it. it's all wonderfully confusing in a lot of ways, you know. Yeah, let me ask you some different things.
The thing that hit me when I was first reading the book and then began to mention it was the size of Boston. Taking a look at, how big is West Roxbury? Does anybody know?
32,000 or so.
Okay, so we're talking three times the number of people that are in all of Boston here in our little place. And we haven't even talked about Rossendale next door, you know. So the whole idea, this was a very, must have been a very rural, spread out area for us to be. We're a good 8 miles from Beacon Hill here.
So this was in Boston.
This was, yeah. This was
right. And she's talking about size conference.
Yeah, and so it's like it was a, sure it may have been concentrated right in the center of Boston for with a number of people, but the idea of losing 1,000 people out of 11,000 is in this very spread out society. I mean, the reason we have our church here is because it was too far to get to the church that we had to go to over the course of the day. So it's that just boggles my mind, the lack of dense population.
Well, Boston proper would have been actually relative to a lot of rural areas or other cities, pretty densely populated. It's also interesting to know that in the city of 10,000, just how cosmopolitan it was. And it was the center, one of the centers in the British Empire of newspaper publishing, of book publishing, of enlightenment, of reason, and so forth, and the college, and very, very cosmopolitan. Much more so than, let's say, the old Williamsburg. So, yeah, come around.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing, I guess, in defense of the doctors.
Are you a doctor?
No.
Okay.
No, but it occurs to me that actually, you know, we are looking at this many years later, and we know an operation works, you know, so we're kind of looking at it as, oh, you know, that makes sense. But then you actually are making people sick.
Right.
You know, you actually are making people sick, and they actually might die from it. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to me like I can imagine saying, well, wait a minute, you're saying they're less likely to die from this than if they get it the other way. But the best thing is that they don't get it. And, you know, so I mean, I can see that as a physician thinking, I can give someone an illness that would be against the difference. You know?
Right.
I mean, so it seems to me like it was very complicated because you were going to make someone sick, and even if you said, you know, Mather and Wilson, you know, saw both their sons get very, very sick, and they could have.
Right.
You know, if your son had been one of those who died, then you would have thought, that wasn't a good idea.
Right, absolutely. And yet we see 6,000 people getting sick, and they knew that. They knew once it was in the town, people were going to die, and people were going to get sick, and a lot of them were going to die. And so what Mather simply proposes, let's just give it a try. If it goes horribly wrong, then we'll stop. But again, I come back to that point about one or a handful of people out to Boston Harbor do this under, you know, and this is very good science, right? Let's isolate the person, and they won't be able to get anyone else sick, and if they're willing patients, you know, they'll choose to do it themselves. And yet, they refuse to do that, you know? So, it is that we can certainly understand. You make a great point. You certainly understand the hesitancy and why they did what they did. We need to understand that for the context. And yet, you know, as much, you know, I was looking throughout the course of my research, because I don't want to make Mather seem some kind of like perfect saint, you know, and all this, you know. But I kept trying to think, what, you know, I tried to disprove, but I was like, what did he do wrong in all this? What did he do wrong? What could he have done different? And I kept, you know, he kept kind of coming out as the man of reason in all this. I think he did two things wrong. One is he waited until an epidemic was very good. And two is, at least initially, they didn't really do a very good job of isolating people. So one guy was being inoculated, but there was a fire in town, and they let the inoculation patients go out and put out the fire. And they made, certainly. And one guy was reported like he had taken his shirt off and everything, and I guess it was in the summer, and he was fighting the fire and working up quite a ladder, and you know, handing buckets and stuff to other people. Certainly he could have spread smallpox to other people, okay? And so that is, you know, we need to give credit where credit's due and blame when we're applicable. But except for this few things, you know.
Question for the present time. About 6 years ago, a chiropractor treated my wife at a retirement home, and among 20 others, gave a lecture about this and that. And I saw the literature, anti-vaccine, 2006, is that permitted by law? Doctors give out literature like that? In 2006, nobody talked about it. It's a bad thing. And I said, if you get both kinds out, even one kind.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, this piece of debate redesign, and most of you know it, and the autism debate and so forth. I mean, I don't want to sort of wander into that quagmire, but I'll say that, you know, we vaccinated our kids, and, you know, I think it's better to vaccinate than to risk these diseases coming back, and a lot of people are taking that chance. We'll continue to go around there.
Thank you. I wonder if you could say something about it, from having a notion that this might be an interesting story to finding sources, whether they were fundable or hard to find, and whether you found divergent points of view that you had to resolve and tell a story.
Sure, it's a great question. Well, I published my book on the hurricane during the revolution, and you know, I was rooting around for new ideas and trying to throw interesting ideas past my editor and so forth. And I wanted, as I described it at lunch with a few of you, I wanted to write a book on the invention, and don't steal my idea. But write a book about an entrepreneur. It's a fascinating story. How, while Benjamin Franklin was over in Paris for the signing and negotiation of the peace treaty in 1783, hot air balloon was invented. And it's just a fascinating look at science and scientific discovery. And it's a little less frightening than smallpox or hurricanes and that kind of thing. It's kind of nice. The first balloon was sent up with, I think, a pig, a sheep, and a goose. Make sure they didn't die until they started sending people up and so forth. And so I was reading all these biographies to put this idea together for my editor as a proposal. And they kind of passed on that idea, I think, to their discredit. But I kept reading all these 800-page biographies of Franklin on my shelf and kept finding all these 2 or 3 page mentions of this epidemic. And I offhanded it, but it didn't go into a lot of detail, so I offhandedly mentioned it to my editor, like, that's it, let's do that one. So go look around, see what you come up with. And I was like, cool, trip to Boston, catch the Red Sox game, drink some Sam Adams, some hops and some chata, right? And would you know it, I found every single source that I knew of in existence, from looking at some scholarly articles written about it to this obscure book from like 1974 or something about the epidemic. Every single source I could find, including Williamsburg or Paul Gilman, the mayor. I'm sorry to say I didn't have an excuse to go up here. I should have lied to my wife. No, I gotta go up there and just drink some Sam Adams all week. But, well, I mean, William and Mary even had the town records of the selectmen of Boston from like 1712 to like 1730. Like, I don't have an excuse to go up there. But everything, every diary, every letter, everything. And I really thought, I mean, this is my favorite book. It's kind of interesting, you know, you all love your children in the same way, they're different. Like, I just love this one, but I really felt like I understood the characters and their very human responses to all of this, and the whole, it was just such a fascinating story in general, and I understood the motivations and so forth. In the end, you know, so I used all the sources that I found, and there were a lot of pamphlets and newspapers and stuff, there were a lot of things to read through. And in the end, you know, I felt like if I came up and I found one or two diaries, they probably would have said something to the effect of, my nephew got smallpox and we were worried about him and he died. I had so many sources which confirmed sort of the general narrative of the story that it didn't look like one or two diaries just recording what happened. We're going to change the substance of my story. story. So at a certain point in research, you have to say, okay, well, that's enough, and then I found enough. And here's the book, and here are the So we have time for a couple more. I mean, I'll talk a lot about
it. Oh, it's the Thomas Walter.
Okay.
The second minister of our church was Nathaniel Walter, who was Thomas Walter's much younger minister. That he was like 10 during this. We wanted him to be a guy. We don't want him to be a guy. He was like 10 during
that would be your novel,
then. Yeah. Well, no, I pass it on to you for an article. But it not just was Thomas Walter a minister, but so was his father. And his father was the minister of our parent church, of the First Parish Church of Roxbury. And that all of these ministers, Cotton Mather and Walters 1 and 2, our own first minister there, were all on Harvard's board of overseers. That the Puritan ministers were all, these half dozen were all on the board of overseers. So they would have not only had gone to Harvard, but they helped determine Harvard's curriculum. So they would have been an even tighter, I would imagine, an even tighter bunch than one moment. So when I saw the Walter in there,
I
was like, oh,
what is this? Proven that I learned way more from you guys than I'm talking to them. So, I mean, I clearly learned a lot. It's a fascinating twist that I just wouldn't have known, and you have access to a lot of local history.
Yeah, so
it's
something I don't mind that.
One curious part of your story was about Douglas withholding his copy of the transaction. But wouldn't there have been other copies that would have had transactions, or did it just the argument get so heated that all logic was lost?
No, I mean, I think Matt would have known, if there were other copies around town, who would have known about. I mean, how many people in Boston read the transaction, right? I mean, not a lot of ordinary words and that kind of thing. And if Harvard had a copy, I'm sure Matt would have known that. So it was just this particular volume, it was just, he had lost it, and Douglas just despicably didn't lend it to him. Not even in any interest of seeing people's lives. It's just horrific to think. I mean, it's just almost just downright inhumane and extremely unscientific. So, at least to say, I washed my hands of it, but here's the book, and so try to save lives, but I'm not involved. I mean, he could have even done that. So.
But weren't they also trying to limit the
kind of
people going from Boston over to Cambridge because they didn't also want to
disseminate
the smallpox
over to Cambridge? True. Could Matt have gone to Boston too? Yeah. I mean, this is not something I necessarily have evidence to. I haven't gone to the Harvard Library or looked at their collection of books from the time, and I can't say for sure whether they had a copy, but I'm pretty sure Matt could have gotten one if they had one.
The answer to your question is clear, but I don't think you could have done anything differently. Quite frankly, doctors, and even doctors today, can be a very opinionated bunch.
Oh, we all can be. We all can
be. Yeah, we all can be. And I happen to be a naturopathic health consultant. I don't have specific training in doing that, but I've learned over the years how I can help people. Work with people and treat people and cure people with stuff that doctors won't touch with a medical at all. And the medical community has tried to, at various times in the last 50 years, put naturopathic medicine, including those who have studied to be naturopathic doctors, completely out of business.
Well, I think it comes down to this, and I talk about it at the end of my book. Here's the famous book, Structure, Scientific Revolutions, but the simple version goes something like this. The doctors practiced structural Roman medicine. It hadn't been changed in almost 2,000 years, and they thought inside this box over here. Mather thought he went outside the box, the thing over here. And so in a certain sense, we can't blame them in the sense for being human. Right? They refuse to think outside the box. And the scientific revolution, this guy in 1862 argued, Thomas Kuhn, that scientific revolutions occur when people step outside the box. And in today's way of thinking would be, you know, stepping outside, you know, Newtonian physics and erasing, you know, Einstein's physics or quantum mechanics and all this stuff. That's still sort of debatable. But, you know, it's a paradigm shift, right? It's a shift in worldview, and that's a very painful process.
Right.
None of us like to have our ideas questioned, right? And sometimes we're not as open-minded as we like to think, and we're not as open to new ideas as we think, and it's a painful process to do that, because basically what that would do today and back then is to force you to rethink everything about what you think about science or medicine. And, you know, think about it today, you know, graduate school programs and new PhDs and the whole education and the whole textbooks, I mean, they have a certain way of thinking. And to go completely outside that to a new way of thinking is extraordinarily difficult. And it's painful. But eventually, that new way of thinking becomes a new paradigm. But in time, that becomes the orthodoxy. Right? That becomes the high-bound way of thinking.
Exactly.
And people are unwilling to go from that box to this new box. Right? Or can I sign that box to embrace new ideas? And so this is, in the end, both a very human story and both a story of how thought takes place among human beings and communities and academics and others. So, yes?
And I was just thinking that to make it more complicated, you have God involved. You have people's understanding of God, but if not, this is God's will, do we dare go against that? And, you know, the whole thing of salvation, and, you know, is this going to cost me salvation?
Your soul, I mean, that's a pretty important question. Yeah, and interestingly enough, again, it's the doctors who are making that argument, and they're Puritans, right? So, you know, they're not divorcing their science and religion, but, you know, matters, again, taking that 18th century natural law worldview, adopting the new scientific view, and sort of not quite deism, but something similar, that, you know, look, God gave us reason to discover truth so we can help people. It's just fascinating, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, what could they have done differently, both medical doctors and ministers?
Right.
I'm thinking, they were busy.
Sure.
Everybody around them was ill. Mather had 368 or whatever people to pray for every day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctors are going from house to house taking care of. So given that level of responsibility and commitment and stress, and then say, okay, divorce yourself from what you know and think about this new thing, it's like this overload.
Yeah, you know, again, in the end, it's a story of humanity. It's a story of people. In real world conditions, these are not just doctors and some, like, NIH-like institute, like, you know, under perfect conditions and dealing with things very objectively. These are real human beings with dealing with a lot of subjective world around them. Their own children, their neighbors, their prisoners. You know, these are difficult questions. And the doctors, in the end, are well-intentioned people. I mean, they don't want... If their view is Puritanism and predestination, they don't want us, you know, suffer their eternal souls or those around them. They don't want people to get sick if they're not otherwise willing. I mean, there's good intentions on all sides, but we all know about good intentions, right? And in the end, you know, there's this contentious debate, and it all gets wrapped up in this very human story. So, thank you for your question. I'll say I have a flight about 8, but I'll stay and answer more questions in chat. And for my other books, I couldn't bring all of them up, but I will take orders if you're interested in them. I will write your name down and get your book this week. Okay? So thanks again.
And you can write a book about the chair
and
the operations.
Broadly.
Done.
Right.
And it would. But it would be a fascinating story. I mean, it's a great story about
Western medical patients came to the West, you know, and the reason why we're